welcome to Inspired Island, where every episode we sit down with someone living an inspired life here on Vashon Island in Puget Sound. From world-class artists and musicians to chefs and business owners, our little rural island has it all. I'm your host, Grace McCray, a new full-time Vashon Island resident, and thank you for joining me on this journey to discover why Vashon is such an inspired island. Hello, and welcome to a very exciting episode of Inspired Island. I wanted to pop in quickly and introduce today's special guest, Amanda Knox. Now, anyone over a certain age will know of Amanda and her story, but if you're not familiar with what happened to her in Italy starting in 2007, I encourage you to do a basic online search, because in this episode of Inspired Island, we're going to go way beyond the headlines and get to know the real Amanda and who she is today. Now, of course, that includes being an exoneree, but also a journalist, a public speaker, author of not one, but two New York Times best-selling memoirs, including her newest titled Free, My Search for Meaning. She's also an executive producer on a hot new show on Hulu called The Twisted Tale of Amanda Knox. Amanda also hosts her own podcast called Hard Knox, and I definitely encourage you to take a listen to that. But perhaps most importantly to this conversation, Amanda is just another Vashon Island neighbor. So I really hope you love this episode. And without further ado, let's get into it. Welcome to Inspired Island, Amanda.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
This is my first time meeting you, but this is not your first time on Voice of Vashon, right?
Oh my God, I love Voice of Vashon. I fantasize about having my own show on Voice of Vashon just because,
like, yes.
I love the idea of, I also fantasize about contributing more regularly at, I say more regularly as if I contribute to the Beachcomber, but like, because I really believe in local journalism and being invested in the stories of a community. And so really like helping a community, like have a sense of its own mythology. And as well as its own current events, like I think that that's a really important thing that is disappearing. And I'm more and more and more aware of how every day newspapers and local radio just disappears because it loses funding and is losing listenership and readership. And first, I don't know how the Vashon local community has managed to sustain itself, eking out its survival on a local journalism level. But it's a valuable, valuable thing that I don't think anyone should take for granted. Like on the ground, you really need just like a human perspective. And that's a really difficult thing to do when you're reporting on a national level or an international level. But it's actually doable on a local level, especially for people who are just really interested in their community.
I'm
curious what your experience was transitioning into, because I remember there was a thing that I distinctly remember when I first came home from prison, which was there was Twitter being quoted on screen next to, like, you know, there was like that scroll that was like on the screen, like my, you know, my family is tuned into King 5 News or whatever. And like next to the reporter who's doing, who's the anchor, who's talking about the story, there's just like commentary from like local people. And I was just like, this is a completely different world than the one that I belonged to before prison, like in that quick of a time.
Yeah.
So
absolutely. It's wild. It's given equal weight. And in some ways it's great. And we see things on the ground that are posted. But again, like now you have to worry about, is this an AI video or that you're seeing online? So it's always
just
a game
people
take.
Responding to the news in real time, right? Yeah. Like I think that people be engaged with the news instead of just sort of passively absorbing it. That's interesting. Mm-hmm. But what a monster it's become.
Yes. A little bit unwieldy. And we're ending 2025 as we record this. And 2025 has been a big year for you, at least the public and professional side of you.
Yeah, a lot of things came out this year for me.
Yeah. So I'm imagining it was probably a whirlwind at times. But you released your latest book, which I have sitting in front of me, Free, My Search for Meaning by Amanda Knox. And then later in the year, your Hulu show, The Twisted Tale of Amanda Knox, came out and continues to be very popular. And at the same time, you've managed to keep up with your own popular podcast, Hard Knox. Plug for that if you haven't listened to it before. And your advocacy for criminal justice reform.
Mm-hmm.
So when you think back...
So how do you do it? Well,
Yeah, what's your secret?
I didn't just do this all this year, right? A lot of this stuff came out this year, but it was years in the making. And a lot of the time that I was working on all these things, I didn't know if they were ever going to actually come out, right? Mm-hmm. Like when you write a book, you don't know until you get the rubber stamp from a publisher that they're going to publish it. Mm-hmm. And you don't know when you're working on, even on a big Hollywood TV show, like the vast majority of the time that I worked on that show, I didn't know if it was actually going to get made. Like more than half the time, I was not certain. Yeah.
That's wild. So was most of the book actually written before you knew?
I wrote the entire thing before I shared it. Yeah. So, I mean, obviously it goes through and it's a little bit different than my first book because my first book I sold on a pitch, right? So I've sold on a few pages and a number of meetings that I took where I explained, this is what I want to do with the book. This is my story. Mm. And because people were really eager to hear my story after I just got out of prison, like it was, they didn't need the full manuscript to know that they could sell it, right?
Yeah.
But when you come to a publisher and say, I have another memoir, they like, if you just go with them to with a pitch, they're like, you already wrote a memoir. What are you doing? Like, how is this even different? And even if you were to explain it very well in a meeting, like, that's not going to convince anyone. You really have to, like, show by putting print on a page what this is and how it has a body and a life of its own. And it's distinct and important and different. And so that's what I had to do. And so I wrote the full entire manuscript, actually shared it with my previous agent, my previous literary agent. And he was like, I don't know, you already have a memoir. So I don't know, like, I don't know if I can, if this has legs. And I said, I really believe in it. And so I went and found a different agent who did believe in it. And luckily, both he and I were right. And we managed to sell it. But it was like, it was a very different journey, both creatively and, you know, professionally as a writer to get this object into existence.
When did you first get the itch of actually sitting down and starting putting pen to paper or typing?
I mean, I've been processing everything that happened to me in Italy for a long time. And my first memoir, in a way, like, I'm really glad it exists. My first memoir, Waiting to be Heard. Yeah. It came out in 2013. So this was when I was still on trial. Like, my whole legal saga was not actually concluded. And I was still, you know, facing extradition. And I was responding to a very, like the prompt of why that book needed to exist was very different than the prompt of why this one needed to exist, right? Like, there was back then, there was this very prevailing narrative about either I'm guilty or I'm guilt adjacent, like, you know, and like, even if I'm innocent, like, what happened to me was my fault. Like, that was the story that was being told. And there were so many people who were making tons of money telling my story without my consent and without my participation. And so I really felt called upon to respond to this narrative that had taken over my life, that had stolen my freedom from me, and to describe the experience of what happened in Perugia and what it felt like for me to go to be on trial for this crime that I didn't commit. That's what Waiting to be Heard is about. It's really just like, what happened? Like, what the hell happened? And that, you know, that's great. That's a great thing to exist. That is a memoir of sorts in the sense that it is historically talking about a thing that happened to me. But like, when I think of the best memoirs that I really care about, they're ones that are not just about what happened. They're ones that derive like universal insights about what happened. And I didn't have room for that in my first memoir. All I had room for was the saga of what happened. And then in the aftermath of that, I'm grappling for years with how do I live with this? And who am I after I've gone through something like this? And I'm having to reevaluate everything, my entire relationship with the rest of the world, with other people, with local society, with internet, like national society. Like, I'm an idea in people's heads and I wasn't that way before. And what does that mean to me? And I felt really trapped for a really long time. Even after I'm out of prison, I still felt imprisoned by a story that I had little to no control over. And that journey of trying to understand that and then unravel it and then carve a path for myself is the journey that I felt I went on, which was one that actually had agency. It wasn't just, what's this bad thing that happened to me? It's, what do I do about it? And that felt more like the kind of memoir that was meaningful to me that I had inside of me. And, you know, I'd been writing for years about various aspects of this, processing it in little bits and pieces. And I finally thought, I really want to put this all together. And I knew that I had a story to tell when I came home from Italy after confronting my prosecutor.
Yeah.
And so that's what this book really leads up to, is like, here I am grappling with trying to make sense of this terrible thing that happened to me. And then I make this choice to go back to Italy and confront the person who put me through it. And what was that like? And what did I get out of that, if anything?
Yeah. And the show touches upon that too. And thinking about putting yourself back into the driver's seat of the narrative about you, it seems like the tone, both of this book, the show, the media coverage in 2025, seems like a refreshing departure from the media coverage the first time around when you first got home with your first book.
Yeah.
Does it feel that way to you?
Yeah, in the sense that, like, the story isn't just about a true crime horror story. It's about the human experience of coming through and making sense of it and, like, making my own decisions again. And I feel like that's a really important story to tell, particularly in the true crime space, because I feel like what I observe in the true crime space is that these tragedies are like a capsule that are a small portion of individual people's lives that come to define them. And everything that happened before and everything that happened after is irrelevant. It's really just like, what is this terrible, horrible thing that we all get to now consume eagerly and with morbid curiosity? And, you know, there is a space for that. There's a reason we do that. It is an important, like, it is in the public interest to examine these cases. But, like, I know from personal experience that there is a life before and then there is a life after. And I don't know, I'm just really rebellious. I do not feel like I should be limited by how the rest of the world sees me. And I feel like I should be able to make sense of it on my own terms. And what I mean by that is, you know, a lot of people after, you know, I went through this experience just expected me to shut up and disappear. And as if it were easy for me, first of all, to go back to being an anonymous person, which it wasn't.
Yeah.
That does not happen. I'm recognized to this day.
We just saw an example.
Yes, exactly. Coming into the Voice of Vashon studio. So going back to being an anonymous person wasn't really an option for me. And also, I'm still grappling with the weight of this experience. And what do I do? What good can I do with it for myself and for others? And so translating that experience, like, this is my trauma speaking. I do not like being told what I can't do. If somebody tells me that something is impossible, I'm like, I'm going to prove you wrong. Everyone thought that, like, I would never be able to return to Italy. And I did.
Yeah.
You know, and all these people think that I should just shut up and disappear and I have nothing valuable to say or offer the world. And I'm like, actually, here it is. Yes. And I'm trying to push back against this idea that the worst experience of anyone's life is the defining experience of their life. And I think that's where it becomes a more universal thing. Like, the thing that I experienced was very extreme in a lot of ways. But, like, we all, especially in that fun stage of our life, which is our 20s, like, we make some mistakes and we become wise, hopefully. And that's what I'm trying to show, is that when you go through a traumatic thing, what does it really take to unravel it?
Yeah.
What does it take to pull that mess apart and then take the you don't just walk away from the mess. You have to like do something with it. So what do you make out of it? And this is just what I happened to make.
And that sentiment, you express it so beautifully in the book in several places, but I really resonated with is the fact that you didn't believe that there was some like cosmic or religious reason why it was you who dealt with this in Italy, or that this had some lesson that you were supposed to learn. Mm-hmm. Whereas it's really is, in my experience as well, especially these more traumatic things that happen to people in their lives, is there is no reason. Like, you know, it's up to you to make the reason and the meaning. And that's, I think, what your book does such a great job of doing. But I think it's very empowering. And,
yeah, thank you. I mean, and that's where it comes back to like, okay, where do I have control? Where do I have power? Because these traumatic situations render us powerless, render us like there's this thing that's called narrative foreclosure, which is that feeling that you're not the protagonist of your own story. You're just some pawn in someone else's, that like that existential dread that results from that feeling of powerlessness. And a lot of people respond to that by feeling like there must be some higher power who's the author of your life. And that gives you some sense of comfort. Like even if you are not in control, something benevolent and all powerful is in control. And I know a lot of people who find great meaning and satisfaction out of that idea. But to me, I was never convinced by that idea. Yeah, however tempting that idea is, I was never like in my heart and in my gut, that never convinced me. That felt like just a comforting illusion. And, you know, comforting illusions are great. They're comforting illusions, but like what is really going on?
Right.
And so for me, I went down a more darker path, which involves like really embracing the nihilism of it all in a sense, where it's like, maybe this doesn't mean anything except to me. It matters to me, though.
Yeah.
And it doesn't just matter to me. It matters to my mom, and it matters to my sister, and it matters to Meredith's family. Like, it's not that it doesn't matter to people. It just, it doesn't have this like universe. Like, it matters to other people for other reasons. And so for me, like, I had to figure out, okay, if there's no like universal reason why this matters at all, then why and how does it matter to me? Why and how does it matter to you? And like, why does this narrative stick in their mind versus this other one? That to me became this like universal truth-seeking quest that I went on, not just to make sense of it to me, but also so that I could understand what happened to me and how to be effective in response.
Yeah.
Like I believe in knowing and understanding the truth, not just for the sake of like having a clear mind, but also so that I can be effective in my own life. Yeah. I don't want to like navigate the world with the premise, like with false premises, because ultimately that's going to lead to self-defeating purposes. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. It's almost like you've had to be an anthropologist of your own story and the world that you were seeing around you.
Totally.
Yeah, and it's the timing of that story, where the media was at the time, it was just a perfect storm. And as somebody who grew up close to Salem, Massachusetts, I had a sick feeling in my stomach about just watching the frenzy around it.
Yeah.
And here's another young woman at the center of this beast that is getting very unwieldy very fast.
Yeah, yeah. You know? And, you know, to this day, I can't quite explain why it became so unwieldy so fast to so many people.
Yeah.
Like, it was this huge thing. And a lot of people are mad about that for some legitimate reasons and some illegitimate reasons. Like, you know, why does this wrongful conviction come to attention rather than this other one? Yeah. I don't have a good reason. All I can say is I hope that huge level of attention on my case rises the boats of every other wrongful conviction story, so that like the next person goes, oh wait, that story now that was so unfamiliar to me, because I have familiarity with Amanda's case, I now have a little bit more familiarity and I can recognize some things in that other case that I wouldn't otherwise pay attention to.
Absolutely. And I've been very fascinated to learn that Monica Lewinsky was another producer of mm-hmm. the show. And it sounds like the two of you have developed a relationship and a friendship.
It goes back to 2017. Yeah. So it's been a second. And, you know, it's been one of those, she lives in L.A. and New York and, you know, is glamorous and cosmopolitan. And here I am like a dumpy chick on Vashti, you know. So like we have both a lot in common and a lot not in common. Mm-hmm. And so when we connect on the things that we connect on, right? And when I first met her, it was in the spirit of this thing that we connected on. We were both invited in. It was taking place in Seattle, this event that was talking about controversy. Mm. And she was a keynote speaker. I was a keynote speaker. Two women who were at the center of crazy controversies. And what did we have to say about them? And I didn't actually get to even listen to her talk. I was one of like the surprise guests. So I didn't get to be out there in front of anyone until like the last minute. So I didn't get to hear her talk. But I did get to meet her in person in her hotel room. It was the first time I had ever given a public talk about what I went through. Because up to that moment, the most I had done was like I had been interviewed for the Netflix documentary, but that's a very different thing. That's like me alone in a room with two people. That's not me in front of a crowd of who knows who. Mm-hmm. When you're talking to a Netflix, you know, journalist for a documentary, you know that they've at least researched the case. Like when you're talking into a room full of strangers, you have no idea what, if anything, they know about you. What they think they know about you, what they think they know about the case. And so it's a very different experience. And up until that point, my vibe from the world was that no one would believe me, even if I put myself out there and poured my heart out, no one would believe me, no one would care. Like people just didn't empathize with me. Yeah. That was what the feeling that I had gotten, especially from being interviewed for my first book when it came out. If you look back, those interviews were very rough and awkward and painful. Diane Sawyer interviewed me for 7 hours. I was just like, and it was not a sort of empathetic discourse. It was very
transactional too.
It was very, you know, it was investigative in nature. Anyway, so this experience of going in front of a room full of strangers to tell my story was very nerve-wracking for me. And so she gave me a lot of great advice and we reconnected over the years occasionally. And she reached back out to me after she had done her own experience of executive producing a scripted series about her story. She had gone through that experience, learned a lot about it, and then wanted to shepherd someone else's story. And she immediately thought of me and reached out and that got the ball rolling. The series would not exist were it not for Monica Lewinsky reaching back out.
Who would have known? Yeah. And the funny thing is, I'm not even much of a TV person. So I watched the show with the hope that it would give me more research for today.
Yeah.
And I'm so glad I watched it because I definitely remember following the story back in the day because I had just gotten back from my own study abroad experience. I think I'm a year older than you, but I remember finding it fascinating. But this show did do a great job of solidifying things. There were some new things and there was like an emotional aspect that I've never really felt it in my body, you know, reading or listening to news reportings, etc. I think like the chaos of the initial crime scene, the overstimulation of the interrogations, the language barrier. I remember I got sick when I was in Spain, and I remember I got sick and I was just got scared really quickly because of the language barrier. I thought I knew Spanish pretty well. It came, it came to light that I didn't know it well. And so I think the show is just, I just a plea to anybody who hasn't watched it to give it a watch.
And you actually have to watch it because the language barrier is a significant barrier.
Yeah.
Like some people, I remember some of the responses of people who watched it was, oh my God, it's almost all in Italian. Like I have to actually read subtitles. And it's
you
can't scroll on your phone while you're watching this show. Yeah. Like it kind of like demands your attention. That was very purposeful. Like I'm putting the audience in my shoes. Of like, here I am in a room full of people And I'm sort of kind of understanding what they're saying, but not really making myself understood. And like that, that was a huge part of it.
Yeah. I mean, I was getting overstimulated at some point during. I was like, how are you supposed to keep your mind straight? It's just, it was pretty wild. And I found it very frustrating at times, just what you were seeing behind the scenes with the case building. Mm. I did read that you were on set sometimes watching this and really...
Like for that interrogation scene, I was there the whole time. Yeah.
How was that emotionally for you?
I mean, it was intense. It was super intense. Like that was the only time that I cried on set. Mm. But like part of that crying was coming from reliving it. And part of it was crying because we had finally gotten it right. Mm-hmm. Like of all the scenes that we were filming for this show, the one that I was most concerned about getting right was the interrogation scene. Both for my own sake, because so many people have vilified me around that event. They're like, she confessed and how, only a guilty person would confess. And so I really wanted to convey what it really felt like for me. But also when it comes to my criminal justice advocacy work, like what happens in interrogation rooms is not known or understood by the general public. Mm-hmm. So really conveying like, no, this is what is really going on behind closed doors. And heads up, this is legal. Like the scary thing is that almost everything that happened to me in that interrogation room was legal. I was denied an attorney, which made the entire thing illegal. But like the lying to me, the yelling to me, the keeping me up at night, the depriving me of food or bathroom, all of that is legal. That happens here in the U.S. all the time.
Like name calling.
Name calling, all of that. And so the fact that that is not seen in the light that it should be and not appreciated was something that I really wanted, like, if there's anything about advocacy that this show is about, it's really about that episode, that scene. Like, what is going on? And this should not be going on. This is not okay.
Yes. So. It was very, very powerful. And I think it's underappreciated the weight of that process as a variable in any sort of case.
Oh, yeah. No, it's huge. It's incredibly so. Confession evidence, interrogation evidence is incredibly impactful in a courtroom setting. Like there are studies that show that if you show the same court completely different evidence, but say in an interrogation, even when their rights were denied, like say a person's like was not entitled to an attorney and technically their interrogation is illegal, the same group of people will find that the person with the confession evidence, even if it's discredited, is guilty, and when otherwise the evidence, without it, they would say that they're not. Mm. And so it's just like wild how incriminating in people's minds the idea of interrogation evidence and confession or admission evidence is. Yeah. People just like really resist the idea that anyone could admit to anything inculpatory when it comes to a case, especially as high stakes as this. Just people can't wrap their minds around how fragile we are in those circumstances. And so that's just something I really wanted to get right. So I was crying a bit from how tough it was to watch that and also from the relief that we were getting it right. Yeah. In the meantime, like it was really refreshing, honestly, to hang out with the actors who are playing the police officers who are effectively harassing, abusing, torturing me in that room. Like they're all very nice people, like they're great actors. And I try to portray that like when they're in that room, it's not that they're mean for the sake of being mean. They're all sleep deprived and they're under a lot of stress. And some of them are trying to be nice to me, but they're like introducing ideas to me that are wrong, even if they're trying to be nice. Like the guy in the interrogation room who's like, well, maybe you just don't remember the truth because of how traumatic it was.
Your brain might be blocking something. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. Maybe you've repressed these memories. And it's like, okay, well, that's very nice of you to suggest, but like you're brainwashing me right now.
Yeah, it is wild. And there's so many questions I could ask about both the show and the book. But here on Inspired Island, one thing we love to do is look back at people's early experiences and if and how that reflects in what they do today. Mm. And is there anything that you feel like right now in your professional world you feel is true to who you were as a child? You know, are there any skill sets that you feel like you're really being able to showcase and delve into that you might have always been predestined for?
Predestined, but
It was always in you.
Yeah, it was always in me. I mean, I've always enjoyed performance. I was a theater kid all throughout growing up. I was in choir. So I always loved music. I always loved performance. And I've been doing more stand-up thanks to the island. The island has really embraced me and giving me the opportunity to test out my comedy chops. So shout out to Richard Moore at Two Drinks Comedy. And of course, writing as well. Like, I've always been a journaler. I've always been a writer. I've always processed my thoughts through writing. And my thoughts and feelings through writing. And I also really enjoy communicating through writing because I feel like there's more precision and intentionality when you write something down to someone versus when you just say it. I know a lot of people really enjoy in-person, face-to-face communication. And I agree that there's something very important and palpable about that that comes from empathizing, from being in front of another person and feeling their presence. At the same time, though, if I've learned anything from this experience, is that memory is faulty and people remember things differently. And even like the same conversation, if you were to recount it, like two different people coming away, we were to recount what was said and what was described, like they're going to remember it differently and they're going to remember different things about it differently. And so I know that many miscommunication results from not having a record of what was said and what was intended so that you can go back and say, okay, well, I did say that, but what I meant by that was this. In human communication, there's this constant conflict between what did I intend versus what did I say or what did I do?
Yeah.
You know, and like a lot of times the people who are on the receiving end of whatever was said and done remember what was said and done. And the people who actually did the saying or doing remember what they intended versus what they actually said or what they actually did. And so, like, there's that conflict. And I think that I really enjoy, or I feel really safe when I have that fallback on, well, what did I really say?
Yeah.
And then I can be held accountable for what I really said, and not what you thought I said or not what that meant to you. Like, how did you translate that in your mind?
Mm.
Like that, I don't know. As someone who's been very deeply vilified for people's perspectives of me, I'm very... extremely wary of being held accountable for people's ideas of what I said or did versus what I actually said or did.
Yeah.
So that's where that comes from. But what that means is that, like, I really rely on the written word to convey my feelings and thoughts, and that has translated into writing. And I do think that something that was true about me even before Italy was that I did tend to empathize with people and try to understand their perspectives. You know, I'm a people pleaser. I'm a bridge builder. Like, you know, I don't know. Like, I'm
daughter.
A girl. I'm an oldest daughter, keeping the peace. You know how it is. So you're just, totally. Like, oldest daughter is actually a legit thing where, like, you are the first communicator of your generation. I spoke for my sisters and my cousins. That's a real thing. And like, in a way, I often felt like I was the bridge between my parents' generation and my generation. And that imprints itself in you as someone who, like, understands that people of different life circumstances have different perspectives of the same thing. And so I've just become more and more and more aware of that as I've grown older. And the amazing reality that, like, any two people can look at the same set of facts and derive completely different conclusions. That just fascinates me. Completely different conclusions, completely different meanings. And
in the classic telephone game.
Yeah. It's nuts.
Yes. Lots of things can go weird in translation. And of course, we're talking here on Vashon Island. And I personally didn't know that you lived here until that New York Times profile came out. But when did your Vashon story begin? Like, where is your Vashon origin story?
I mean, my Vashon origin story goes back to before I was born, because my grandparents had lived here for over 50 years.
Yeah, yeah.
My dad grew up here, and I grew up coming to visit here all the time when I was a kid because my grandparents were here. I grew up in West Seattle, but like, you know, just up the hill from the ferry dock. Mm. Literally, I could walk from the ferry dock to my house. And we would come very often to visit my grandparents. And I have many, many memories of walking on the beach with them, of running around their orchard. They had an apple orchard, watching their hummingbirds outside the window and collecting seashells and, you know, doing all of that. So I have a lot of roots in Vashon, even if I didn't grow up living here. And then I moved here in, what year was that? 2019, I think. Yeah, 2019 is when I moved here, right before the pandemic.
Yeah. What? Yeah, I know.
It was a fluke. I wasn't intending to move here per se. I just went. We had friends who were going house hunting, and we just decided to go with them, and then fell in love with this house and committed to the Vashon life, which, again, we weren't really thinking about, but was kind of perfect for us because both my husband and I are writers. We both work for ourselves. We don't have to commute anywhere. It's, you know, safe. The only thing that I was a little bit hesitant about was the small town vibes. I'll be honest. Mm-hmm. Like, I knew that in Seattle, at the very least, I could potentially go somewhere and not be recognized.
Yeah.
I get recognized a lot, even in Seattle. But, like, I get recognized every day here on Vashon. And, you know, that's fine because it's small town vibes. Like, everyone recognizes everyone.
Yeah.
But, like, that was a little intimidating to me when I first moved here because I was a little more timid about strangers recognizing me. Like, I still didn't have positive experiences of that. Like, most of the time when I had people I didn't know recognizing me in public, it was nerve-wracking. Even if they weren't mean to me, there was this definite sense of, like, you know, othering, right? Like, I'm this other object and they're suddenly coming, you know, I'm, again, this idea in a person's mind. And, like, it's a lot of pressure to be an idea in another person's mind and then to suddenly come into contact with them. It's like, it just...
Especially when you might just be going to get milk or something at the grocery store.
Exactly. You just want to go get milk, you know, and you're just like, oh, God. But, like, since moving to Vashon, I've had very positive experiences of the normal being recognized by your community, not because you're necessarily you, but just because you belong to the community.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not just the girl accused of murder here. I'm Amanda, the girl who lives here, who's your neighbor. And that feels really good to me.
Yeah.
I really like that.
That's lovely to hear. Yeah, there's no real sense of anonymity here.
Exactly. Like, so it's like, it almost like evened the playing field for me, you know?
Yeah, but it's like, I can't go to the grocery store without knowing somebody.
Exactly. Yeah. We're all in each other's business. Yeah. You can't go to the grocery store without being recognized. And that's universal here. Yeah. So I'm good with this.
So the Pacific Northwest, you write about it so beautifully in your book, et cetera. Has the thought crossed your mind to move to L.A.? Or?
Oh, God, no.
Okay.
Oh, God.
Because I was thinking, like, you've been New York.
The thought has crossed my mind on a professional level.
Yeah.
Like, oh, it would be so much easier for me professionally if I went and settled down in L.A. or New York. But, God, I would hate it. Mm. I'm a Pacific Northwest girl. Like, I just am. Mm. Like, I, that's not the pace of life. That's not the style of life that I want. I want something slower and safer and more organic and natural and outside. That's not my... Down there or way over there is not my vibe. This is my vibe.
That's good to hear. And I know you do travel a lot, but when you're at home, you speak that you and your husband, Chris, work from home. Probably a lot of times are sending your own schedules. Are you a routine person? Like, do you have a day in the life on Vashon type routine that you follow, or no 2 days look similar?
I mean... I instinctively reject routines because I don't... They're a little too institutional for me.
I get where you're going.
However, just the natural, like, rhythms of life that they happen. Like, I don't have a strict bedtime routine for my kids, for example. However, we all tend to get sleepy around this time. And so it ends up being like we have a natural rhythm that is a kind of routine. And we've had, because we're in, you know, we're self-employed and we have to be self-disciplined. And so in many ways, we have to be more intentional with our routine just to make sure that we get the things that we want done. Like, for instance, we've had to implement a kind of routine to make sure that I can still get exercise. Right.
Yeah,
like if I don't have a routine, like I'm learning to employ routine in order to save space, to make space for the things that I very intentionally need to make space for, because otherwise they can get lost in the rigmarole of life, especially when you have two young kids. Do you have kids?
Yes, two.
Okay. So you have kids. So you know how it is. Like kids and work will take up your entire life if you don't like set time for yourself to do the things that are important to you for you. So I have to schedule time to go to the gym, you know, or like time to, I don't know, what's another thing that I really, that's really, like my husband and I are trying to get a date night on the books because, you know, otherwise we're either on kid duty together or we're on work duty together and we don't have just us duty together, you know? So that's where I'm trying to embrace routine, even though instinctually I rebel against the notion that things start at this time and end at this time, you know?
And since moving to Vashon, I'm also more aware of the seasonal changes, too. Mm-hmm. Like with the, I think my life, my energy, my sleeping habits look much different now we're nearing the shortest days of the year versus in August or whatever.
Yeah. It's a way more sleepy time.
Yeah.
It just is. Like
it's gray.
And it looks 8 o'clock at 5 o'clock. Yeah, and it's like, well, I guess I'm getting sleepy now. Like that's just, you just listen to your body and your body's like, it's sleepy time now. And
so let's get on the PJs. Oh my goodness. So you mentioned stand up. Do you have any places you draw inspiration or creativity to help fuel some of your other things you're working on?
Let's see. Where do I draw inspiration from? I mean, the things that I end up focusing my attention on are things that I'm working through, that I'm trying to figure out. So I'm drawn to books or interviews with people that help me to navigate a question, a burning question that I have. And a huge burning question that I have is, why do people believe the things they believe? Mm-hmm. Just why? And is it possible for people to change what they believe? And if so, how? Like that's a really interesting question that I've been digging at for a long time. And I do that by reading, by talking to people who have knowledge or experience in that. How else do I get inspiration? I mean, one thing that's been really transformative for me since becoming a mom is play.
Mm.
I have a 4-year-old and a 2-year-old, and a lot of my time and energy is spent playing with them, which you can look at it in two different ways. It can either be this sort of like mind-numbing experience, or you just like embrace it for what it is. And you're just like, now I'm a Tyrannosaurus Rex and I'm chasing, you know, the leprechauns around the room, like, you know, like whatever game we happen to be playing.
And
just trying to be really present. Another thing that's been an incredible resource for me on the island and a huge inspiration has been the Puget Sound Zen Center. So, so big shout out to the Puget Sound Zen Center, where I am a member. I never thought that I would be a go to church on Sunday kind of person, because I never have been. But having somewhere to go where I have a community of people where we are all in a spiritual practice, but one that really resonates with me, which is about like stillness and centering and the truth that comes to mind when you are just very present, very focused on the present. That has been incredibly transformative and inspirational. I just think we're incredibly lucky to have that resource here on the island, because it's a really, really good one.
Awesome. Well, thank you.
Yeah.
And Amanda, the last thing is, we end every show with a little lightning round of questions.
Let's go.
You ready?
Yeah.
Okay. Do you have a favorite beverage on Vashon?
Ooh, last word. So my favorite beverage, like cocktail-wise, is the last word. It's a cocktail, and they occasionally have it at Ruby Brink.
Okay.
Otherwise, I'm all about that chaga matcha with oat milk that I love to get at Little Cup.
Okay, perfect. And if you're not at home or work, which for you, I guess, is the same, where can people most often find you on the island? Like, do you have any favorite haunts?
Favorite haunts? Probably Granny's.
There you go. That's a good one. My kids would agree with you.
And do you have a favorite Vashon Island tradition?
Oh, definitely the crazy bike ride, the stupid bike ride.
Okay, I think you're probably the last five guests, probably four people have said this. I need to go.
I've never been.
No.
Oh, no, it's so special. Okay. It's really special because it's also very kid-friendly, which is amazing.
Okay, yeah.
And like seeing it through my kids' eyes has made it that much more special. Like, one, it's like Halloween. It's got that energy of Halloween where everyone's out there together, but typically it's not dumping rain yet.
Yeah.
And like, it's just the extravagance of this bike ride, ultimately. Mm-hmm. It's just like it's so Vashon. It's also very Burning Man. Have you ever been to Burning Man?
No, but I have friends who have.
Okay, yeah. It's like a very Burning Man thing to do. Just like put lights on bikes and make that a special occasion. Good times all around.
All right. I'll be there next time. And lastly, where can people find you to learn more about you and your work?
The best place to go is amandanox.com. You can find all of my work there and reach out if you want. I'm also on Instagram at amamanox, on Blue Sky at amandanox.something.something.
I don't know. You can find it. I'm on Blue Sky. I'm on Twitter. I'm on Substack. And I have a podcast called Hard Knocks.
Yes, I love it. Well, thank you so much for making time for us today, Amanda. This has been very exciting, and it means a lot that you came in.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me.
And thank you for listening. Again, this is Inspired Island on Voice of Vashon, KVSH LP Vashon, your listener-supported island connection. Until next time, stay inspired.